Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. We're always glad to hear from listeners and those who go to the website and read the articles posted there. And we often learn a lot by what you write us. And it's very interesting. I can almost predict every time we write a major article on homosexuality or same-sex marriage, we get the same kind of response. And that response comes down to this. Why aren't you talking about divorce? Because divorce is a far more significant enemy of marriage than same-sex marriage. Now, there is something I want to acknowledge here, and that is that I think the argument has traction. I think if you just look at marriage as an institution over the last several decades, to this point, at least, it has been more subverted by divorce than any other single enemy of marriage. And the availability of no-fault divorce, the near universal expectation of the availability of divorce, all these things have undermined the permanence of marriage, have literally redefined marriage as a tentative and perhaps even transitory and temporary institution, and have served really to undermine the integrity of marriage from top to bottom. I agree with that. What I do not agree with is the suggestion that we don't talk about it, because I have also learned that every time we talk about divorce, I hear from people who say, why do you talk so much about divorce? Well, we try to talk about the issues day by day and week by week that are most pressing and that represent the greatest challenge to Christian thinking and Christian faithfulness. So we are going to come back time and time again to certain issues, because it is clear that we've got to make a lot of progress on these issues, because in many cases, either the progress is very slow towards a recovery of theological and moral sanity in the church, or we're actually losing ground. And on the divorce issue, well, it's a complicated picture. But I want to come back to that issue time and time again, especially when there is a new point of data or a new angle of analysis that helps us to understand how we arrived at this rather dangerous moment for marriage, especially as it relates to the question of divorce. My guest today is going to be Professor Brad Wilcox of the University of Virginia. He is one of the most brilliant scholars dealing with marriage and family and community today. He's a sociologist. His stuff is absolutely insightful. Every time I see an article or a book by Brad Wilcox, I know it's going to be worth talking about. He's written a brand new article at the new journal, National Affairs. He's written an article on the evolution of divorce. And there is some spectacularly important stuff here. First of all, he really looks at how divorce happened legally, sociologically, culturally. He looks at what it meant and how, for instance, no-fault divorce has led to any number of other social ills and pathologies. He looks at the impact of divorce in the lives not only of the spouses or former spouses, but of their children in the larger society. He points to something, however, that I think most people simply do not even know, and that is that there is a great divorce divide in this country today. That divide is nothing less than remarkable. Right now, there is good news on the divorce front for those who have a college education. College-educated Americans are less likely to divorce now than 20 years ago for all kinds of reasons. That has been a reversal of a trend, and it looks like that we're actually gaining some ground there. But for those who do not have a college education, who by socioeconomic or other context are less likely to have that educational opportunity, divorce is becoming more and more rampant. And as a matter of fact, it is spreading like a virus throughout certain sectors of our society, which had been, at least in previous decades, more resistant to the idea of divorce, especially folks in rural areas that had perhaps held out longer for the marriage ethic but are now succumbing to the divorce culture as well. By the way, I saw a statistic just in recent days that only 3% of all unwed births are to college-educated women, only 3%. And yet, 40% of all babies born in America are born out of wedlock. You put those statistics together and you ask all kinds of questions. Does that mean that college-educated women are morally superior to those without college education? No. It does mean, however, that they probably have more at stake. They probably have more at stake in terms of the issue of unwed motherhood than do others. And for that reason, it's important to understand that we're looking here at pathologies, at patterns that are tied together. You know, which comes first, poverty or divorce? Well, that's a question that is insoluble, but it does become clear that poverty and divorce do go together. Which comes first, unwed motherhood or what you have in terms of low educational attainment and low educational aspiration? Well, I think that's very difficult to answer, but we do know this. They are tied together. Brad Wilcox is one who helps us to cut through an awful lot of the smog of statistics and get to the heart of the issue. And I'm looking forward to that conversation in just a moment. We'll also provide a link to his article on the evolution of divorce. And I'll be writing about the same subject and posting an article at my website in just a few days. In the meantime, we need to look at some issues in the news. USA Today is out with a very interesting article. Atheism 3.0 finds little room for religion. Daniel Burke, writing for Religion News Service, is talking about the fact that the new atheists are really rather divided. They're divided over the most interesting question for an atheist. Should an atheist try to evangelize for atheism? You just think about that for a moment. You realize that really is a potentially controversial question for atheists. There are some atheists who are just kind of quiet atheists. They don't believe in God. When pressed, they will give their reasons why they do not believe in God, but they feel no mandate whatsoever to try to lead others to forsake belief in God. But on the other hand, there is a new, more aggressive variant of atheism, and whether it's represented by Christopher Hitchens or by Richard Dawkins or by other figures in the media and in the culture, it is clear that they have a more aggressive intention. Now, I like what Daniel Burke is calling this new atheism. He calls it Atheism 3.0. Some, however, even among these new atheists, are beginning to look at religion and say, maybe it's not such a bad thing. Maybe even though we don't believe in God, religion has some good social effects. Maybe even though we see that the belief in God is irrational and ungrounded and baseless, those who believe in God do derive certain social benefits from religion. Let me speak as a theologian to that. That is not why I believe. And I don't believe that any person should respect religion simply because of its effect on people, or because of its supposed social improvement and cohesiveness. Let me put it this way. If there is no God, it should be scandalous to believe in him. If there is no God, then those who believe in him should be understood, not only to be confused, but wrong. I'm a believer in God, you bet. I'm a Christian, a believer in the Lord Jesus Christ. And I believe not only that there is a God, but there is a God who is and who speaks. He is and he is not silent. He has spoken to us in his word. He has redeemed sinners through his own son, the Lord Jesus Christ. And I believe that belief in God is the most important thing that confronts any single human being. We are sinners desperately in need of a restored relationship with our Creator, and that comes only through the gospel of Jesus Christ. And the issue of belief is absolutely paramount. So how do we look to these different variants of atheism? I'll tell you the honest truth. I think I'd rather face an atheist who's really bold in his atheism. I'd rather face an atheist who's really clear and honest with his arguments. I'd rather face an atheist who understands what's really at stake than somebody that tries to carve out some middle ground saying, I don't believe in God, but maybe religion does some good things, makes people behave, leads to greater social cohesiveness. You know, I can't believe the Apostle Paul or the other apostles of the church, and beyond that, the Lord Jesus Christ, will be honored to know that people respect his church primarily because it makes society work better or makes human beings behave just a little better. There's got to be a whole lot more to it than that. There's always another hand when you look at an argument like this. And the other side of the argument is this. Just maybe, the actual moral influence of Christians in the spirit of Peter writing to Christians living under a time of persecution, that they should live in such a way that their holiness draws persons to Christ. Maybe there is an opportunity for the church in faithfulness, living out holiness, to indeed help draw persons to the gospel of Christ. Maybe the church living out what it means to be faithful to Christ actually provides some proof positive that the indwelling Christ does make a difference. Other interesting things going on have to do with the election that is coming up in certain places in this country. We have gubernatorial elections, especially in New Jersey and Virginia, catching an awful lot of attention. And in Maine, just 6 months after the governor of that state signed a law legalizing gay marriage, the voters will decide whether to preserve it. The November the 3rd ballot initiative there in Maine is going to be a bellwether for the issue of same-sex marriage across the country. We ought to be paying attention to that. And we ought to be encouraging those who are seeking to defend and to define marriage in Maine. If indeed this effort to pull back this legislation and reverse the authorization of same-sex marriage in Maine fails, there'll be those who will claim it as evidence that America is beginning to turn in terms of its conscience and mind on the issue of same-sex marriage. Folks, there is no breathing space on this issue. There's no way after, for instance, California's passage of Proposition 8 to say we made a statement, now we can rest. The people in Maine had better be on the alert. We'll be right back with more on the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. The issue today is divorce, and my guest is Professor Brad Wilcox. He's Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Virginia, member of the James Madison Society at Princeton University. He is a man who's doing some of the most important research, in my view, being done anywhere in America right now. And my advice to you is when you see his name on an article or a research report or a book, read it. We're very honored to have Professor Wilcox on the program today. Professor Wilcox's new article in National Affairs is entitled The Evolution of Divorce. Professor Wilcox, what are you talking about there? I think most Americans just think of divorce, legal divorce, no-fault divorce, as a fact of nature. You make very clear it has a history.
You know, that's right, Dr. Moore. Basically, what we saw in the early 1970s is that most states in the United States adopted what's called no-fault divorce, which basically allowed either spouse to leave their marriage for any reason whatsoever, or really no reason whatsoever. And not surprisingly, we see a pretty dramatic increase in divorce in this country in the 1970s. So the point is that divorce rates can change. They can go up and they can go down.
Well, and as you make clear, there are significant effects in the lives of individuals, especially children, in the lives of couples, and in the lives of a society about that. But, you know, you begin your article on the evolution of divorce with an anecdote about former President Ronald Reagan that goes back to 1969 when he was the governor of California. And it in itself is kind of a parable of how we arrived where we are now.
No, that's right. Back after World War II, Ronald Reagan and his first wife were having some marital problems. He was becoming more conservative, actually, at the time, and his wife was more of your standard issue Hollywood liberal, and she was, I think, not happy with his turn of events. And so she had to come up with some reason, because they had fault-based divorce in California at the time, and she was accusing him of mental cruelty. And I think, of course, that experience was not a pleasant one for him, and he wanted to figure out, you know, a way that he could kind of reform divorce laws, without having that kind of false accusation issued. But unfortunately, in so doing, he basically, and the state of California, gutted, you know, any meaningful consideration of marital conduct prior to considering a divorce. And I think that is really both unjust, and it's also it's unwise in the sense that it's made it easier for couples with kids to divorce, and that, of course, is bad for children.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the history there is very instructive because it's a reminder to us that legislation can often have major league unintended effects, and that certainly is true, I think, when it comes to Ronald Reagan serving as governor of California, not only on the divorce issue but also on the abortion issue.
But that's right, and on both those two issues, he expressed later the view that those were two of his biggest mistakes as a politician.
Yeah, and he learned from them, and it's very clear that he was not ashamed to speak of the effects, because when he was president, he pointed, for instance, in calling for welfare reform to the effects of divorce. And you really document in your essay here in National Affairs on the evolution of divorce an entire cascading set of tragedies that really evolve from divorce. And the reason why we really need to talk about this is because even within the church, there are many people who just assume that divorce is some kind of legal necessity. They even assume, and you point this out in the case of a statement made by the United Methodist Church, that perhaps divorce isn't the worst thing under many circumstances. I want to point to several different issues in your article, but before we just get to the effects, you make the argument that there's been a major shift, not just from divorce being hard to get legally to being easy to get, even unilaterally a demand of one spouse, but you talk about the greater shift from an institutional model of marriage to a very different model, for instance, a soulmate model. What's really going on there?
You know, basically, you know, two or three generations ago, and for much of our nation's history, you know, marriage was about many things. It was about love, it was about children, it was often about shared faith, but it was also about, you know, mutual companionship, about sharing, you know, the economic load in the household. If you were running a family business, for instance, it was about taking care of a sick wife or a sick husband or a sick, you know, mother-in-law. And we had a kind of, I think, a richer and more fully orbed understanding that marriage encompasses many goods. Unfortunately, in the last 30 years or so, we've begun to narrow down our understanding of marriage just to think about that emotional connection between husband and wife. And that's a very fragile connection. And when that goes for a day or two or for a month or, you know, whatever it might be, I think couples can be tempted to seek out divorce court, not recognizing that there are all these other goods implicated, you know, in their decision to divorce, like, for instance, the welfare of their kids or even their own financial future.
You know, I appreciate very much your sociological analysis. As a theologian looking at this, I try to make the distinction between the objective reality of marriage and the subjective experience of marriage. You know, I'll have people that will tell me, I've had it in a pastoral situation, say, I don't feel married. Well, without regard to your feelings, you are married. And, you know, it really gets to the fact that there is an objective set of obligations and responsibilities. It's an objective relationship recognized by the state and, even more importantly for Christians, by the church. And yet this companionate understanding of romantic soulmate marriage has really subverted marriage. And yet, you know, that would shock many people. And I want to test the theory with you. I really think that the point you're making is that this idea that marriage is nothing more than a relationship for mutual satisfaction, this has really undermined marriage.
I think that's basically on target. I mean, I think if people simply look at their marriage as an opportunity to have emotional and or sexual intimacy and to enjoy that for life, you know, they're really, they're basically taking a distorted view of marriage, which ironically or paradoxically enough, is on average going to lead to unhappiness and often to divorce, because when people see it in these kind of narrow terms and evaluate marriage in these narrow terms, they're less likely to give of themselves to their spouse in marriage and less likely to actually enjoy, you know, a rich marriage that is really predicated on the gift of self towards your spouse and then the receipt of a gift, you know, from yourself to you in the marriage.
Let me ask you another very pointed question. We're living in a society increasingly, believe it or not, it's hard to believe that we could become more and more therapeutic in our worldview, but I'm convinced we are. You point out that there was a psychological revolution in the late 1960s and the 1970s that also played into this. How did that work?
Well, basically, you know, in the 70s, as many people know, there's this kind of focus on me and on fulfillment and on personal satisfaction. And on intimacy, too, on having authentic, intimate relations with others. And, you know, basically, this whole focus on the self and on emotions did a real disservice to our appreciation of, you know, the fact that marriage is, as we've just talked about, you know, many more things than just, you know, a personal relationship between two adults. And particularly, it made it difficult for people to appreciate how there could be a tension between their own emotional state and the welfare of their kids. You know, so for instance, it may be the case that, you know, the best thing to do for your children is to stay together as husband and wife, even if that may cause you either some temporary or long-term distress. And what happened in the 70s is that many people came to value their own personal emotional needs over those of their children.
So there were these massive shifts that took place attitudinally, in the level of worldview, and then in the law. And Brad Wilcox documents from 1960 to 1980, the divorce rate more than doubled. And by the time we arrive where we are now, there are millions of persons whose lives are affected by divorce. When we come back, I'm going to ask Professor Wilcox why the impact of divorce is such a controversial issue and why there are so many people who simply will not see the data, the evidence that is there for all to see. I think we're morally obligated to see it. We'll be right back on the Albert Mueller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. My guest today is Professor Brad Wilcox. He's Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Virginia, also a member of the James Madison Society at Princeton University. He's doing some of the most important research out there on families and children, gender, religion, and the stability of American family life. Evidence of his research and I think the keen nature of his analysis is seen in an article entitled The Evolution of Divorce, published just recently in the journal National Affairs. Professor Wilcox, in one sentence you write, 30 years later, the myth of the good divorce has not stood up well in the face of sustained social scientific inquiry, especially when one considers the welfare of children exposed to their parents' divorces. You talk about the morning after. What should we learn from this?
Well, you know, back in the 1970s, there were a lot of sociologists and especially psychologists and even some clergy who thought, hey, you know, kids are pretty resilient, they're pretty strong, they can bounce back, you know. Yeah, a divorce might be difficult for a year or two for a child, but, you know, after that, they'll make an adjustment. And, you know, a lot of people kind of buy into this whole myth of the good divorce. But, you know, after about 20 years of sustained research on the impact of divorce on kids, a lot of serious sociologists and psychologists came to a different conclusion. They concluded, basically, that divorce increases between 2 and 3 times kids' risks of experiencing serious outcomes like depression, delinquency, and dropping out of high school. And so, you know, the picture that's now emerged 30 years later is that divorce really poses a substantial risk to the welfare of our kids.
Can you document that a little bit? I mean, you certainly do in your article. I mean, you really go at the fact that about 1 million children per year since 1974 have seen their parents divorce. And you make the point, which I just saw documented in other research, that even remarriage does not really resolve that issue for children. Divorce has a lasting and immediate effect in the lives of children whose parents divorce.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, in fact, the issue of remarriage is really an important one because what we find is that kids actually don't tend to do better in step families compared to stable single-parent families. And so I think oftentimes parents have this idea that, oh, I'll get divorced, I'll remarry, I'll have a new husband, new father for the kids, and that just unfortunately just doesn't work out very well. Kids tend to like to have a connection with their own mom and dad and not with that new man or a new woman in their lives. So that's really the issue that we're seeing here in the literature.
You know, I saw some research just recently, Professor Wilcox, that demonstrated that, for instance, adolescent girls and pre-adolescent girls can often have very, very negative experiences and impacts in their lives even when their mothers remarry to a good, stable, responsible men, simply because it's a foreign experience for the girl at that stage of life.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, girls who are in a stable single mother household actually have, they have their first menstruation earlier than kids who are living with their dads. But girls who are living with a stepfather have their first menstruation even earlier. There's something about, you know, biologically about being in proximity to an unrelated male, it seems to set off something in teenage girls. So the point simply is that step families are no solution here from the perspective of kids. And in fact, they often make things worse as you try to, you know, shoehorn one more adult into the whole picture. And the better thing, you know, vast majority of cases is for parents to figure out how they can reconstitute and reform and renew their marriages. Both for their own welfare and for the welfare of their children.
You know, looking beyond the statistics, you make the argument that we should note the ways in which widespread divorce has eroded the institution of marriage. You point especially to the way that divorce undermines quality, prevalence, and the stability of marriage in American life. You know, I see all those things all the time, and it seems to me they're all taking place simultaneously.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, what I show in the piece, for instance, is that cohabitation has skyrocketed in part because a lot of young adults have seen their parents divorce or their friends' parents divorce, and they want to have a test drive to make sure this thing is going to, quote, work, you know, before they get married. Of course, what they don't realize is that by cohabiting, they're actually increasing their risks of divorce. So, you know, there are a lot of, and we also know that kids with divorce are themselves like 89% more likely to get divorced than kids who haven't been affected by divorce. So, yeah, this is kind of a vicious cycle here, and we have to have, I think, you know, dramatic action on the part of churches and other institutions to try to, you know, break the cycle of divorce and to renew married life in the United States.
When we come back, we're going to talk about just that. My guest today is Professor Brad Wilcox of the University of Virginia. You know, by the way, the fact that so many young people say they are reluctant to marry because they don't want to divorce, especially when they are the children of divorce, indicates just how much they know and are willing to let us know that divorce is not a good experience for children and that they do not want to repeat what their parents did. We need to pay close heed to that. Listen and learn. We'll be right back.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. You know, as we have conversations about things that matter, and we really try to focus on those things, we try to think about how we should intelligently grasp an issue and how as Christians we should try to take it apart, put it back together, analyze it, and come to a reasoned conclusion that leads to action. You know, on the issue of divorce, I'm really somewhat double-minded because on the one hand, I want us to go over, I feel obligated to go over again and again what we already know about marriage and what we already know about divorce. But when I see something that's new and unexpected, I also want you to know what may surprise you. And when you look at the article by Professor Brad Wilcox, now in the current issue of National Affairs, his article, The Evolution of Divorce, one of the most interesting sections of his essay is on the divorce divide. And it tells us something that ties to so many other issues, whether it's the poverty issue, the unemployment issue, economic issues, family stability issues. What Professor Wilcox is demonstrating in this section of his essay is that there's now a divorce divide in this country, and it's largely a socioeconomic divide. Professor Wilcox, how did that happen?
That's a great question. And what I'm showing in the article is that basically divorce rates have been coming down among college-educated Americans since 1980, but they've been increasing among Americans without college degrees since 1980, you know, even above and beyond where they were, you know, in this divorce revolution in 1970. So something's happening where working-class Americans basically are having more and more problems in the marriage arena. And I think that there are really probably two important explanations for this. One is that the wages of working-class men have declined. And so I think that working-class men are less attractive, both in the eyes of their wives and the eyes of themselves as, you know, as husbands and as providers. Another piece, though, is that working-class Americans actually are more exposed to the popular culture. And they're more likely to be shaped, I think, by things like what's on our TV nowadays. And as a consequence, to be making bad decisions based upon what messages they pick up from things like, you know, ABC, CBS, and NBC. So I think that there is both a kind of a cultural explanation here at work as well as an economic explanation. And they both come together to help account for this divide in American life between college-educated and less-educated Americans.
Let me test a theory with you based upon your essay and that based upon your research. It appears that when you go back to the 1960s and the 1970s, it was the more educated classes, the more elite classes that were really kind of the leading edge of the divorce revolution. But you're making the point now that that persons who have college degrees and are pretty safely in the middle class, that they're actually now more traditional, more likely to support traditional marriage and traditional child-rearing practices than those who have less education and less stability.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they are taking more traditional attitudes when it comes to marriage and divorce-related questions. And I think it's probably because they have access to the economic resources that make a traditional model somewhat more accessible to them. But I think it's also because they're often likely to have read about studies, you know, like the ones that I've done or others have done, you know, and the effect of divorce, you know, on on their children. They realize that if they want to get their kids into Harvard or into UVA or Yale or Stanford, whatever it might be, you know, it makes a lot more sense for them to stick, you know, stick together rather than get divorced. I think that's part of the equation too. There's a kind of a status concern about, you know, staying at a certain level, both for their own sake financially and otherwise, and then for their kids' sake as well.
Professor Wilcox, what would you have us to do? In your article, you make clear that there is responsibility that falls upon parents, spouses, churches, schools, public officials, and as you point out, the entertainment industry. But just focusing on where most of the folks listening to this program are going to be able to make a difference, what would you have us to do?
Well, I think that there are two things. One, on the legal arena, I think we can reform divorce laws. Not to go back to the fault-based divorce, that's not, I don't think that's possible. We can, though, I think, reform our divorce laws to take into account marital conduct prior to the divorce. And that we would have basically an assumption that the spouse who did not want the divorce would get primary custody and would get the bulk of the marital assets, unless it could be shown that the other spouse had engaged, you know, in some kind of egregious conduct.
Now, Professor Wilcox, can I just stop you there for a minute? Because I have to say, I find that almost Solomonic. You know, having been concerned about the no-fault divorce issue or even more specifically the unilateral divorce issue, having so many people that call this program and say, my spouse just announced that we were getting a divorce and now I'm robbed of my children. It seems to me that your proposal, it just has incredible wisdom in it. I wonder, why has no one seen that or tried that before?
Well, because I think people have thought we have to go back to the old regime. That's the only route, you know, forward. And I think that's not politically prudent to try to go that road. Whereas trying to inject a measure of justice would, I think, honor the marriage contract or the marriage covenant, and it would also have the unintended or the intended consequence of actually reducing the divorce rate. We know that states that actually do a better job of awarding joint custody, authentic joint custody, in the wake of a unilateral divorce actually have lower divorce rates. So if we were more just about the divorce process, I think we'd actually see a reduction in divorce as well.
You know, I think putting it this way, it would seem to mean that lacking egregious behavior, the spouse that decides to leave the other spouse would also be making the decision to leave the children. I think that'd be a pretty sobering realization.
Precisely. I agree 100%. And the other thing is that I think that, you know, that we can do is that we can encourage our pastors and our priests to do a better job of preaching about marriage, you know, just preaching about kind of what it's really meant to be, what it's ordained to be, and then also being very concrete, though, in terms of stressing the virtues that are required to live married life successfully. And it's, you know, I think we need to be reminded over and over again in terms of what marriage requires and how we should conduct ourselves in our marriages, to be encouraged to sacrifice one for the other, but also to be appreciative of the differences between men and women. I think that's often a big issue that tends to emerge, where wives are looking for one thing, husbands are looking for something else, and they're not on the same page together.
Professor Brad Wilcox is Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Virginia, member of the James Madison Society at Princeton University. I think his research is really, really important. And I want to point out one other thing, and that is I think it's a very courageous body of research and publication here. You'll want to see his article. We'll provide a link to it at the New Journal National Affairs. In his article, he says that we need to return to a more institutional model of marriage. And I think that is profoundly wise. And that's why we dedicate so much attention on this program to just that recovery. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You know, social science is opaque and difficult and confusing to a lot of people. All you have to do is look at the newspaper and you'll understand that we are drowning in an absolute ocean of statistics. You've got all kinds of think tanks and study centers, universities and colleges putting out reams and reams of data. But digging through all of that to make sense of it is really a gift. And that's what Brad Wilcox has done for us. He's really been digging through all of that. And with the skill of a sociologist on the faculty of the University of Virginia, he really sifts through it. And I'm sure that there's more to it than just social science here. There's a keen insight into the most fundamental questions that really affect the way people live. You know, the issue of divorce, for instance, in the article written by Brad Wilcox on the evolution of divorce, is not presented just as a social phenomenon that we're seeking to understand. The data there point to very real lives, lives of people you and I know that are affected by divorce, lives of a generation produced by divorce, lives of children whose futures have been significantly altered by divorce, the lives of individuals whose expectations about the permanence of marriage have been subverted by divorce, and the future of a civilization which, having compromised marriage, now undermines the permanence of every single institution. When you disrespect marriage, you disrespect everything from the government to the church. You disrespect the institutions that God has given us, because marriage is that very first institution. And when we are confused about marriage, subvert marriage, undermine marriage, compromise marriage, teach and live falsely to marriage, when we turn marriage from a permanent institution into a temporary contract, we're doing more than rearranging a social institution. We're subverting human happiness, the context for human thriving. We're changing not only the legal definition of marriage, we are altering the habits of the human heart. And for those of us who are Christians looking at this, we realize that the damage, the direct and collateral damage of this is beyond our calculation. You know, for Christians, the issue of marriage is important to us for a different reason, and that is this. We are pointed to marriage as the picture of the relationship between Christ and the church. We are pointed to marriage as a reminder of the covenantal love of God towards us. When we subvert marriage, especially those of us who are Christians, we actually are aiding and abetting the confusion of the gospel. The issue for us about marriage is not new. The divorce issue has indeed, as Brad Wilcox demonstrates, evolved. But there is also hope that we can make a difference in terms of regaining a marriage culture. Not for the glory of marriage. Not merely for the health and happiness and thriving of our neighbors and loved ones. But ultimately, for the glory of God. I'll be back tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday on the Albert Mohler Program. We'll see you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.